This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
So I've been neck deep in the summer educational program these past few weeks. Things are starting to wind down now, and it's good to be back in the studio with these fine gentlemen. I really appreciate Jeremiah taking over the host chair and Sam Livingston filling in as well over these past few weeks. We're going to start today's show in Europe, where this week leaders agreed to a coronavirus bailout package. It was a contentious process, but it marked a real milestone in the development of a European superstate, as is prophesied in the Bible. For this story, we'll go to Richard.
Yes, it was some of the toughest and most angry negotiations that Europe has had for quite a while. It took 90 hours over 5 days. Leaders were calling each other names. Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, and then the French president, Emmanuel Macron, walked out together at one point as a coordinated show of frustration. But by the end of it, they finally hammered out this bailout package that they've been talking about and negotiating over for months. And it's a really interesting proposal then that they've come together, because people have been looking at this in two different ways. You look at it economically, and it's not very much, and it's not that impressive. Now, $750 billion sounds like a lot of money. I mean, I wouldn't say no if somebody was offering me 750 billion euros. It's about 860 billion US dollars. But then you spread that out over 7 years and over 19 different countries, and then, you know, that becomes actually not that much. And then you start looking through the details, and a lot of it is just bits of money that they would have gotten anyway, but repackaged a little differently so that they can have this high headline figure. There's other bits where there's certain conditions that they have to meet that will kind of almost make them a bit useless. So there's a lot of economists looking at this and saying, well, this is no big deal. This isn't going to solve the Europeans' problems. They're going to be back talking about another bailout. It's also a corona bailout that's not going to start to kick in for another year. So you think about the, you know, the real economic problems being caused by coronavirus and the response, a trickle of money over the next 7 years is not going to really dent that. But then you start to look at what this has done politically, and that's where this gets really significant, because this is the first time that the EU as a whole is borrowing money, and they're going to borrow money and then hand it over to these to the different nations, and then they'll pay that money back over decades. And it is a big step. The EU knows it's a big step, because the nations that are not in favor of it have been very, you know, they've worked hard to really emphasize this is just a one-off, we're never going to do this again, but you know, they know that they're crossing a line. And you know, you think about when it comes to economics, this is a one-off that's never going to, I mean, income tax at one point was a one-off that was never going to happen again,
right?
So it's an important line that has been crossed, and that's also then gaining a lot of people's attention as something that is very significant.
Gerald Fleury has said that Europe's response to the coronavirus would be really one of the most significant things that came out of this whole crisis that has taken hold of the world. And the economic unification of Europe is something that we've been watching for a long time. There's a lot at stake and a lot of contention over it, because individual nations want to hold on to their individual sovereignty. Giving up that to the extent that they adopted the euro was a big step. But this is really taking that to another level entirely.
It is. And then it's also empowering Europe's central government, which is not the most clear and obvious and democratic. You're giving the European Commission now the ability to borrow money and play with it. I mean, they will use this as patronage. You know, you think about this being a corona response. Europe actually cut in this bailout package, it actually cuts European spending on pandemic responses. So you know, this isn't about spending money in the most rational way. It's about pork barrel spending, and it's about now you've got this central bureaucracy with a lot of money that it can now use to buy itself more power and influence. And this is what the Telegraph's Ambrose Evans-Pritchard focused on this week. He talked about it being an economic pop gun, but a political howitzer, and that it's a big change in Europe. He pointed out that where else in the world does a single unelected body have the right of initiative on legislation and the executive powers of a proto-government and the spending prerogatives of a parliament all wrapped in one? And that's the European Commission. He said that, that what was being proposed is bordering on totalitarian in constitutional terms, mostly unchecked by meaningful parliamentary oversight. And then he went on to say that it was Cesaro-papist, a word kind of harkening back to the Holy Roman Empire and this union of total command of both church and state. So you know, when you think about what Mr. Flurry said right at the start of that this corona crisis and talking about it, like you said, being one of the most important things to watch. And then you look at some of these quotes in our newspapers saying, well, this is creating a near totalitarian regime with little oversight and all this money to spend and a political howitzer on the way to European unity. And you can really see why Mr. Flurry made those comments.
So talk about the prophecy and what has informed our forecast that Europe would unite economically and that you would have this kind of decision-making power seized increasingly by a central government.
So Mr. Flurry spent a lot of time going through this prophecy in that article that he wrote, Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire. And so this is just the briefest summary, but you can get a lot more in that article. But the Bible has a lot to say about a Holy Roman Empire, a union of church and state. And Revelation 17 describes this as a power that rises and falls. It comes onto the world scene, it dominates the world, and then it disappears, and then it comes back again. And you can see through history how that this has happened six times. The Bible says it will happen seven times, that there's one more coming. And the Bible talks about it being a dictatorial power. It's led by kings. There's a strong leader over the top of it. You go into the next chapter, Revelation 18, and it talks about it being an economic power. It dominates the world's economies. Revelation 18 talks about its fall, and it talks about how all the merchants and traders, you know, the world's businessmen mourn when this power collapses. So we're looking for the rise of a dictatorial power in Europe that's also at the center of the global financial system. And so you can see how what's happening with the coronavirus is pushing Europe into that direction. And Mr. Flurry in that article, he also talked about how the Bible says that it's going to be a 10-nation power. And you can start to see, I think, moving in that direction, even just with how divisive this 90-hour-long summit was and with world leaders calling each other names. And you know, you can see that a 90-nation power, it's not going to work for much longer. And there are other commentators pointing at that and saying, well, Europe's going to have to get leaner and meaner. Mm-hmm. And that's something else that we're watching for. So all of the Bible gives us a pretty comprehensive and detailed picture of what Europe is going to look like. And you can see coronavirus pushing Europe in that direction in all of these different details. And so it's just a fantastic proof of Bible prophecy in action and a great place to watch your Bible come alive in world news.
Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy is the article that our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, wrote a couple of months ago. We also have an article up on the website right now by Daniel DeSanto. This went out as our trumpet brief earlier this week. Europe agrees on coronavirus recovery fund. We will link to both of those articles in the show notes for today's program. Go check those out for more understanding of the prophecy that we're talking about here. Thank you very much for that, Richard. Over to Israel now, some unusually violent protests in the streets against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. To learn about this, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, we actually talked about this last Friday because we didn't know if they were going to continue, but they certainly have inside Jerusalem. Jerusalem has seen seven major protests in the past 10 days. And they are protests that Jerusalem does not normally witness. These aren't protests of Arabs against Jews. They are protests against Israelis or Israeli Jews against the prime minister. And the police have been called out to all of these and had to disperse crowds, including last night, with water cannons. These are not things that you normally see on Jerusalem streets used against their own people, against Israelis. It hasn't happened, but it's in history, but it's happened again multiple times these past few nights. The police have tried to say that you have to leave these protest areas given a certain time at midnight, and yet the people are staying. There was about 4,000 protesters last night at Paris Square near the residence of the Prime Minister. And it's really kind of getting out of hand. The Prime Minister is trying to do what he can. Lawmakers are kind of trying to do what they can to put a stop to it. And yet the people still are out on the streets. A lot of them have different reasons for being there, they'll say. Maybe it's the coronavirus, the economic impact from the coronavirus. Maybe it's the fact that he's pushing towards Prime Minister wants to annex parts of the West Bank. Others are upset that he doesn't support social workers enough. Then there is obviously the ongoing indictments against the Prime Minister that they believe that he should be gone. But they're all coming together with this mixed bag of ideas, and they're coming together with a fury directed at the Prime Minister that hasn't been witnessed in terms of a mass movement, violent movement against an Israeli leader in memory.
Everything that they seem to be protesting is something that has been around for quite a long time. Why the sudden uptick in this kind of resistance?
What's been noticed by people that have been protesting, let's say, for the past 3 years or two and a half years against the Prime Minister, is that it was mostly older, middle-aged folks, that particularly from the left, that wanted Netanyahu gone. And yet over the past 2 weeks, there's been mostly young people taking to the streets. And that's really been a first against the Prime Minister. There are several organizations that are represented at these protests, about 50 in total, different interest groups. One of the larger ones goes by the name of Darkenu, and this is a protest group that harkens back about 5 years to when it was created. It was created during the 2015 election, and that was this massive groundswell, a grassroots movement that was trying to mobilize what they said is the moderate Israeli center. And yet this was a movement that was sponsored in part by the United States State Department under Barack Obama, that was trying to get supporters or a large number of supporters for this group. And then after the election, and it failed to bring down Netanyahu, the group changed name and became Darkenu. And now it boasts about 600,000 members on Facebook. And it has mostly mobilized youth, early 20s and younger. And they want to come out now, and they've had their call out to come out and start protesting against the Prime Minister. And so they're taken to the streets, and the youth, just, they have a fury that just the older people do not. You don't see amongst the older people. There's a lot of older people that are cheering them on as they go. This is getting a lot of attention in Israel. And I think some of these younger people are unaware of the impacts that such social unrest can have to them. You can have quotes of the young people saying they believe that this is the only way to bring down the dictatorship, or that Netanyahu is destroying democracy in Israel. Just these really bizarre claims, considering that, you know, so many people in Israel do want Netanyahu to rule, and he's been democratically elected. And so it's hard when you read press reports about this for them to catch, to try and link the protests that are going on around the world, the United States and Britain. But really, if they did link them to these other ideas about destroying or anarchists trying to take down the system of the United States or Britain, then it would kind of be less directed towards Netanyahu himself. So they do play down the similarities between these protesters and the protesters in America. On Tuesday, we had somebody for the first time stand up atop of a menorah, the seven-branch candelabra that used to grace the temple, and have, you know, ripped off her shirt and started. She had an Antifa flag and wrapped herself in that. And no one really focused on that too much. But this was a desecration of an Israeli religious symbol, and a symbol of the state. and a direct link to what we see going on with statues coming down in America and Britain as well. And yet no one seems to be really linking it, that is outside of the left-wing media bubble over here in Israel. But really, it is these protests seem to be part of the same in the same spirit as the protests that we're seeing inside the United States and Britain, and now that violence as well is crossing over towards Israel.
Well, you know, the division within Israel and Britain and America, this is really something that we have been tracking for quite some time, but it is escalating. You wrote an article, Brent, that's up on the website now. The Next Jewish Revolt, we'll link to this in the show notes. But you talk about just how there's always been a certain amount of resistance on the streets in Israel to the prime minister. But what we're seeing now is a level of violence that we haven't seen before. The same thing is happening in the United States. That we'll talk about that in our next story. But we, as our editor-in-chief has drawn attention to so many times, as Abraham Lincoln said, quoting Jesus Christ, a house divided against itself cannot stand. And when people are so divided like this, eventually it is going to have serious ramifications for the survival of the state. Thank you for that, Brent. We'll move on now to Andrew, a similar story, many American cities also being battered by violent protests. And it's causing something of a standoff between President Trump's commitment to law and order and Democrat leaders who want to undermine the president. For this, we'll turn to Andrew.
Yeah, violence in American cities is definitely getting worse. Portland, Oregon, specifically, they've had riots every night since the George Floyd killing happened. Now, that killing sparked protests in over 2,000 cities. A lot of those have died down, but Portland keeps going strong, and Chicago is a lot of that, still more gang violence, but the violence there's going up as well. And shockingly, considering anything looked at as normal, the authorities in both Chicago and Portland are doing very little, if nothing, to get these protests and shootings under control. And it's gotten so bad that, like I said, in Portland, they actually set fire to a federal courthouse, which prompted President Trump to send in federal agents from the Department of Homeland Security and the Marshals Service to protect that courthouse and other federal properties. Which is perfectly legal to do. The federal government can use federal forces to protect federal property. But it really came to a head this week with the mayor of Portland coming out really strong about how she does not want federal officials in her city. She doesn't want people trying to stop the protests. She just wants to let them continue, which would start a bit of a national debate over the constitutionality of sending these troops in here. Those questions get complicated about federal involvement and local law enforcement. But in this case, defending a federal courthouse and federal property, that is really uncontroversial. And President Trump's not backing down at all. We started the week with the mayor of Portland accusing him of being a dictator for sending these federal troops to Portland, and he responded by ordering 175 federal troops to Chicago, and making comments that he's like, well, Baltimore and Detroit and Oakland are just as bad as Chicago and Portland, so maybe they'll be next if these federal troops seem like they're gonna get some stuff done.
Yeah. It's remarkable just how deep the animus is on the part of these Democrat leaders to resist him stepping in. And it, just the mindset that believes that it's the best policy to allow this destruction to take place rather than confronting it, and the president stepping up and fulfilling his constitutional responsibility to keep Americans' lives safe, for them to defy that truly is revealing.
Right, because especially in a case like this, it's not like these protesters in Portland are like crack special ops people that need the U.S. Marine Corps or anything to take care of. It's like under normal circumstances, President Trump should not have to send in federal troops to protect the courthouse in Portland because local or state police should be able to handle the type of protest we're seeing there. The reason the protests have continued for 2 months, almost 2 months, is that the local police aren't doing anything or hardly anything, prompting the federal police to have to come in there and really do their job for them and get these protests under control. But then there's the risk of escalation as well, just because the media and these Democratic mayors from these big cities have lined up so far beyond the protesters, and they have quite a bit of clout and quite a bit of following over the with the 65 million Americans who voted for Hillary Clinton the last election. And so what you're seeing here is you've gotten a small number of like Antifa protesters who've made a big enough crisis because the liberal politicians in the cities they're protesting on have let them do it, that the federal government's had to send in federal troops to take care of this, which has then prompted those same left-wing media and liberal mayors to condemn the federal troops as a dictator, which is really pushing more and more of those, like I said, 65 million Americans who voted for Hillary Clinton into the almost as allies of Antifa against President Trump.
Mm-hmm. The division is growing starker, exactly what we were talking about on a larger scale with what's happening in Israel. We've been talking about the dangers of civil war. Our editor-in-chief has talked about that quite a lot based on prophecies of the Bible. In some ways, we're already seeing early stages of this playing out violently in America's streets.
Right, yeah. Prophecy after prophecy in Isaiah 1 and verse 7 about your cities are going to burn with fire. We're definitely seeing some of that. Even the federal courthouse is burning with fire. And then in Ezekiel 5 about this getting so bad that a third of the country even dies in it. So these are some pretty sobering prophecies. And you're even like mainstream news sources, you are hearing more and more talk about civil war. In some ways, this is kind of... even some of the legal questions are kind of reminiscent of the first civil war about what does the state governments have the right to do and what does the federal governments have the right to do and can you send federal troops to bring a city or a state who's not following federal law into line. And so those questions, they really, when they start getting out of control like this, it's just like a lawless spirit that Antifa's kind of lit the spark for. But I don't know. There's a lot of tinder in the political divide in America that spark. It's those fires. They just keep spreading.
Well, we ignore those prophecies of what is to come of this division to our peril. You can read Andrew Miller. His article, President Trump Sends Federal Agents to Cities Facing Violence, that is up on the website as of yesterday, and we will link to that in the show notes for today's program. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. We've also witnessed violence in the streets in cities in Germany, and this is violence that has the potential to bring out some of the nation's most troubling tendencies. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, so over the last month or so, we've seen a couple of cities in Germany break out into violence. First, it was Stuttgart, where they had the police. Well, that was in June. The police said things just got completely out of control, and you had youths kind of just running riot. And then just over a week ago, Frankfurt had a similar outbreak. About 40 people were arrested. There was a kind of a big outdoor party. And then it became aggressive and you had running fights with the police. And both headlines have gotten Germans asking a lot of questions about, well, you know, how is this allowed to happen? What is going on in Germany and what can we do about it?
So who is behind this violence, Richard?
Yes, that is the important question. There's... a lot of people looking into this and talking about how that this is – it's large it, – people that have a migration Hintergrund is the German word, a migrant background. That's kind of the most politically correct way, I guess, for the media to put it. What you read between the lines and read between what they mean by that, they're talking basically about young Muslim men, or at least young men that have come into Germany from these various different – from the Middle East and some of these different Muslim countries. And if you've followed German politics at all over the last few years, you know, you'll know this is a bit of a political football. This is something that that has come up frequently. You had most notably a few years ago mass sexual assault in Köln on New Year's Eve, and again there was people from a Muslim background were behind that. The press are reluctant to talk about this, and they'll often comment and write about these incidents in ways that don't talk about the background or who's behind it. They'll just kind of talk about it being young men in general. And so in the age of the internet, you know, that doesn't really hide anything. The truth gets out there. Mm-hmm. And then people only end up feeling even more strongly about it because they feel like the press is trying to pull the wool over their eyes. So this is feeding into a narrative that has kind of gone away in recent weeks. You know, the coronavirus has been such a dominant headline and some of these other things that Germany's migration crisis hasn't been front and center in maybe the way that it has done at other points in the last few years. But these kind of riots are bringing it back as a major political influence. And the Alternative for Deutschland is already talking about this and saying, well, look, we're bringing in migrants into our cities and they're causing outbreaks of violence. I think it's Stuttgart that is kind of meant to be known as this center for law and order. And so they're pointing at this and saying, look, these places that are known to be really well organized and known for being meant to be very lawful places, Frankfurt, that's Germany's banking center. This is kind of what they want to be, Europe's alternative to London, that it's breaking down. I think I should also say that I think you're seeing similar things in London. There are similar videos of migrants, you know, having these same kind of parties and then smashing up cars and attacking police officers and young men. I guess the background is often a little different, but there's nobody really wants to talk about it over in the UK. But then in Germany, it is becoming a big political issue.
We talked about this for quite some time, and I'm remembering a cover story by TheTrumpet.com's managing editor Brad McDonald, Germany, Migrants, and the Big Lie. I think this was a few years ago. And just how much great a problem they're creating for themselves by pretending this doesn't exist. As you said, you have Germans who they recognize the reality, and the more the authorities and officials try to obscure the real nature of these kinds of attacks, the more resentful the public becomes. And it's exactly this type of thing that has led to the rise of far-right political parties, that has caused even some mainstream politicians to have to shift some of their positions more to an anti-immigrant type of rhetoric. This really could, as much as they're trying to prevent this from blowing up, it seems like their efforts really have the potential to backfire.
That's right. And you can see as this goes forward, it ties in very strongly to a couple of really important trends that we've been watching. You know, we talked in the first story about this kind of rise of an autocratic Europe, this Europe that is led by a strong leader and led by kings. And you can see how if law and order breaks down, people will crave a strong leader, be more willing to vote for a strong leader. And this European power, when you look at what it's described in the Bible, it's something that is, you know, what we would call far right, or something that is kind of different from, say, mainstream leftish politics that you see in Europe. So you could really see this pushing Germany in the direction that is prophesied. And at the same time, other scriptures talk about a clash coming between Europe and Islam in the Middle East. Daniel chapter 11 especially talks about this clash between a European power and a Muslim king of the south. And you can see just this, again, this narrative of, well, it's Muslims behind this attack, feeding into these alternative attacks, feeding into that kind of a clash. So just like the coronavirus, this is another news story where you can see all of the different details of Bible prophecy and events being pushed in the direction of all of those details. And you mentioned that article, and it was Germany, Merkel and the Big Lie. That's probably a good place to go to learn more about this and to see some more of those different prophecies.
Very good. And we also have an article up on the website by Josue Michels about this. These recent events, migrant violence shakes Germany. We'll link to that in the show notes, as well as Brad McDonald's article. Thank you for that. Richard, you're listening to Trumpet Hour. We have more stories coming up. We've neglected Jeremiah here in the first half, but he's itching to give us his stories in the second half after we take a short break. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The U.S. says that Russia is testing a dangerous space weapon that escalates the threat of satellite warfare. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, on Thursday, the U.S. Space Command announced that it has evidence showing that Russia has tested an anti-satellite weapon in space. So the test actually happened on July 15th, but it was only just made known to the public yesterday. And it's interesting because the Russians carried this test out with a specific satellite that we've been following very closely on Trumpet Hour. It's called the Cosmos 2543, and it actually launched back in 2017. And the Russians said it and its parent satellite were just innocent inspection satellites at that time. But this February, we talked about how they were trailing some U.S. spy satellites in orbit in a really threatening way. The Russians actually navigated the 2543 at that time to within a distance of the U.S. satellite that was said to have been very dangerous, just dangerously close. And so now we have this same Russian satellite, the 2543. It has released a new object into orbit, and then Russia used that object to conduct a test of a space-based weapon right there in orbit. So the test was apparently non-destructive, but John Raymond, the commander of U.S. Space Command, said that the test still reveals the destructive nature of Russia's space ambitions. He said, quote, "This is further evidence of Russia's continuing efforts to develop and test space-based systems and consistent with the Kremlin's published military doctrine to employ weapons that hold U.S. and allied space assets at risk."
Russia has been a pretty strong advocate of arms control in outer space. This really undermines that position, doesn't it?
It really does. This exposes a lot of hypocrisy from the Russians, and that's a big part of this story, really. Christopher Ford spoke about that aspect of it this week. He's the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State, and he said, "This event highlights Russia's hypocritical advocacy of outer space arms control, with which Moscow aims to restrict the capabilities of the U.S. while clearly having no intention of halting its own counter-space program." And then he goes on to say that that's true both for ground-based anti-satellite weaponry and what we've just seen, which is space-based anti-satellite weaponry. And this is really consistent, I think, from Russia. We saw the same sort of thing on glaring display with the INF treaty, where Russia wanted America to strictly abide by that while they developed and deployed the very weapons that treaty outlawed. And now we're seeing the same thing with these space-based weapons. Russia goes around trumpeting the importance of outer space arms control, but then they turn around and conduct an outer space weapons test. So I think Christopher Ford was exactly right when he just pointed to this as just a glaring display of Russian hypocrisy.
Satellite warfare is an element of warfare that we haven't seen exploited too much, but there are a whole lot of people who warn that this could be catastrophic given how dependent on satellites America and other nations have become. Maybe you could just show why, contextually, why this is so such a major threat.
Sure, yes. And you're right. It would be more of a threat to the U.S. than any other nation, just because of the fact that we have more satellites that we depend on in orbit. The U.S. has hundreds of satellites that we depend on for everything from weather monitoring and television broadcasting to telephone and internet technologies. And then, of course, there's our GPS system, which cost about $12 billion, and it provides users with positioning and navigation and timing services of all kinds. And then most importantly is that the United States military relies on satellites for, you know, reconnaissance systems, communication systems, navigation systems, weapons targeting systems, just about everything you can imagine. Military analyst Bill Gertz wrote about the threat posed to all these satellites recently. He said, all of these low Earth orbit satellites are now highly vulnerable to Chinese or Russian anti-satellite weapons. And then there's another really interesting bit of analysis here from Steve Lambakis. He discussed this recently, emphasizing especially the military's vulnerability. He said, U.S. space systems are among the most fragile and vulnerable assets operated by the U.S. military. This infrastructure is worth billions of dollars and is vital to nearly every activity of the United States and increasingly the armed forces of U.S. allies as well. So there's just so much on the line here. You know, if the right satellites were taken out, it could be truly catastrophic for America.
Mm-hmm. So looked at through the lens of Bible prophecy, what is it that draws your attention in this story?
Yeah, well, Bible prophecy talks about a time on the horizon when the United States and some of its allies will be besieged by Russia and its allies. The books of Ezekiel and Deuteronomy give some just some very specific and chilling details about that. And then Isaiah provides more information about it. In Isaiah chapter 59 and verses 9 through 10, the people of America are actually shown to be stripped of vision. This passage is amazing. It says, quote, "We wait for light, but behold obscurity. We wait for brightness, but we walk in darkness. We grope for the wall like the blind, and we grope as if we had no eyes. We stumble at noonday as in the night." So this is, I think this is already true in a spiritual sense. That's the main application of the scripture. We heard from Andrew in the first half just about how spiritually blind a lot of America is already becoming, just how we're groping around in utter blindness. But I think that the vision that is absent in this prophecy here could also possibly include some physical types of seeing, including that that is provided by satellites. So when you put all these scriptures together, it really makes it more clear just how the U.S. could be besieged, especially if its satellites are taken out early in that process. And in light of these prophecies, I think this story about Russia conducting this anti-satellite test is just a really important one for us to keep a close eye on.
Well, thank you for that. Jeremiah has an article up on thetrumpet.com. Russia carries out space-based anti-satellite weapons test. Go check that out. We'll link to it in the show notes, as well as our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, that really gives the overview of prophecy with respect to Russia and China. Quite an amazing story. If you have not studied into that, you will find it very illuminating. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Iraq's prime minister visited Iran this week, and he got an interesting lecture from the supreme leader there. To learn about this, we'll go back to Brenton Octagon.
Yeah, this is Prime Minister Mustafa Kadhimi. He was made prime minister a couple of months ago, and that was after a couple of tries to get a prime minister following the huge riots, you'll remember, that took place throughout Iraq, October, November, December of last year, going into and through the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. And then Mustafa Kadhimi came forward as being a potential prime minister, and he was vetted both by the United States and by Iran, and the Iranian leadership were fine with him becoming prime minister. And so he made his first visit outside of Iraq this past week, and he came to Iran. He had a meeting with Javad Zarif, the foreign minister of Iran, a week previous, or a couple days previous, and then he got to meet with Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and they discussed well, the things that they discussed to the press was basically that the United States is corrupt, Khamenei said to him, and that he really does expect the United States to be removed out of Iraq. He said this, quote, well, just in terms of the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, he said this, the United States, quote, killed your guest at your house and explicitly confessed to the crime. And basically what he meant by that was the United States took out Qasem Soleimani, who was the head of Iran's Quds Force while he was inside Iraqi territory. And the United States, that was your guest in the country. United States took him out and brags about it. They're the type of the people that the United States are. And so he had one meeting with Khamenei there. He also met with the Secretary Council head, Ali Shahani, who last month called the United States a malicious terrorist threat inside Iraq. And so these are a lot of individuals that have been pushing for some time for the United States to get out of Iraq. And they're meeting with the Iraqi prime minister, and the main goal of their discussions is to talk about the need of a close relationship between Iraq and Iran. There are a number of business deals that were discussed during this visit. And then you have Khamenei getting ready to visit the United States here next month, in a week or so. And so you have directly prior to that, Iran getting in there, telling the prime minister of Iraq what they think going forward. And that is that Iraq is going to be far better off without United States forces there in the country.
A lot of people have been concerned that Iraq has fallen far too heavily under the sway of Iran. Those observers watching this meeting and listening to the way that the Ayatollah was speaking to the Iraqi prime minister, what do they take away from this? Does this show, yes, this confirms just how deeply Iraq is under Iran's sway, or is there something more nuanced than that?
Well, I don't think that those people would see anything strange about the comments by the supreme leader to an Iraqi prime minister, especially in front of the press. The supreme leader from Iran has never shied away from telling people what he thinks, and he does think that the United States should be gone. The big question is whether Khamenei has the power to extricate himself from Iranian control, even if he wanted to. And people, I just read an article 10 minutes ago during this recording, just to catch up myself with some of the details about what other people are talking about. And the Atlantic Council in the United States is normally a more of a liberal think tank. And they are basically saying that it doesn't matter what the Iraqi prime minister says or does. Iran has so much control over Iraq right now that he is limited in his choices. This man was somebody that headed up an anti-terrorist unit, Khamenei, and so he did target, he did help out U.S. forces with fighting against Islamic State, give them intelligence, U.S. forces, and so he is considered more of a centrist. But the fact that Khamenei, who's the new leader of the Quds Force replacing Soleimani, was there 2 days before Khamenei was even made prime minister showed the world that this was a choice that Iran would be satisfied with. And you have him now going to talk with President Trump in the next week or so with the direct lines of what Iran wants inside Iraq. You know, there could be this little window of opportunity that the United States would be looking for to extricate U.S. forces from Iraq prior to the election. It could be that Iran has said something like, we will hold back our forces. You go tell the Americans, we'll hold back our forces for the next few months, and so that the U.S. forces can leave under good terms, looking like they're not running away from Iraq. There is that type of chatter going on. We know that the United States wants to leave. We know that Iraq wants to straddle this fence as best they can. And you can smell the way the wind's going inside Iraq, and that is that the United States wants to get out. And so he's got a hard job. Where's the position, regardless of all of what might happen, why did he say this? No one denies now that the power of Iraq belongs to the Iranians, and the Iranians can dictate at will who's prime minister, as they did in this case with Khamenei. And again, they see that the United States is going to leave Iraq. The question is the timing. Now, we have expected this, obviously, to take place for a number of years. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry, talked about it back in 1993, that Iran was going to end up dominating Iraq. When Saddam Hussein was removed from power in 2003, he did say that this was going to lead to eventually the fall of Iraq to Iran. And he based that on a biblical prophecy that talks about the in the end time, you were going to have two major power blocks wrestling over the Middle East, and America isn't a part of it. American forces aren't there in those prophecies in Daniel chapter 11. You have this king of the South, which we can prove through our booklet, the king of the South is radical Islam led by Iran, and that king pushes at the king of the North, which is a united Europe and led by Germany. And to really make the powerful push, we talk about its pursuit of Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons or what it's doing in terms of oil choke points in the Middle East. It really does need the help of another mass Shiite country. And the only one that exists is Iraq. And that also will give the Iranians great access to more of Iraq's oil. I think they have the third largest reserves or something like that. And so Iran has always considered the need to ensure that Iraq is in its back pocket before it further expands its hegemonic aims. It needs Iraq to be in its corner. And that's what we're seeing now with this pressure on Khademi before he comes to the United States for the removal of U.S. forces. Without those U.S. forces there's only 5,000 of them, but it is a tripwire for Iranian expansionism. If any of those 5,000 forces are hurt or damaged or attacked, the U.S. then has an interest to take out Iran. And so Iran might be happy to have a couple of months of peace with the U.S. and Iraq if it means that they're gone there from there for good.
Where would you send people for more information?
We have an article coming out next week about this specific visit. It's entitled Iran Pressures Iraq on U.S. Withdrawal. It goes into the prophecies on this. Of course, there is our booklet, The King of the South, that goes into greater depth.
All right. Thank you very much. Brent, tensions between the U.S. and China keep growing worse. And this week, a surprise announcement that marked a new low. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, on Wednesday, the United States government told China that it had 72 hours to close its consulate in Houston, Texas, which means it closed just a couple hours ago if they made deadline, which they did. But now, this is really took a lot of people by surprise, but the official making the announcement, the Assistant Secretary of State David Stilwell, said that the announcement was long overdue, and said China had been involved in a series of maligned activities, including visa fraud and research theft. They highlighted a couple instances of a plane coming to the United States where the United States had given a couple science visas to some Chinese students, but the Chinese students weren't the ones that got on the plane. Some other Chinese officials got on the plane and used those science visas to get into the United States. They also highlighted some specific instances from the Houston consulate of them giving instruction to local researchers, science researchers in Houston. They said, don't use your company emails when you email the consulate, because we don't want American companies knowing what you're telling the Houston consulate, because a lot of it is, at least allegedly, trade secrets. Houston's been it's really a hotbed for American innovation. They've got a lot of science researchers down there. I actually worked down there for 6 years, a couple different companies, doing research and development in the oil industry and in the electronics industy. And actually, when it was in Dow Chemical, we even had one of our scientists. He wasn't from the Houston lab. He was from the Louisiana lab, but was arrested for selling trade secrets to the Chinese. I think he gave him a proprietary formula for how to build a better vinyl hose. So not necessarily a huge national security risk there, but Dow Chemical was pretty annoyed with it.
Yeah,
just from an industrial standpoint, is they'd have preferred if people bought that type of hose from them and them alone. But it's So no, this is definitely a hotbed for research, and so you could see why the consulate there, if there's an organized Chinese attempt to take research and development trade secrets back to China, that Houston consulate is well placed, and one of the main reasons the United States is wanting to close that down.
What sort of response are we seeing from China?
About what you'd expect. I mean, they've protested over it, and I think they just made a. Isn't that they're going to pick one of our consulates in China and have it make it and close it down. So it'll be a tit for tat. You close our consulate, we'll close your consulate. I think it just really highlights this relationship between America and China going sour. Yeah, even the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, he gave a pretty blistering speech on Thursday talking about the need for America and the West to rally against communism, and accusing China of being allies with America's top enemies, Russia and Iran, and talking about how they're taking over our trade routes, our basically our sea gates. They're stealing our industrial secrets. They're taking away our industrial base by having using slave labor there. So I mean, this is some pretty heated rhetoric between the United States and China, and. We have an article we can put in the show notes that was just published recently by our editor-in-chief titled Where the America-China Clash is Heading. And that covers a lot of the prophecies we've already discussed in this program about trade war, but also just highlighting that for so long, America and China's economies have been so intertwined that the idea of a trade siege between America and China is almost hard to wrap your mind around, because it would hurt China as much as it hurt us. It takes a little bit of time to disentangle these economies before you can ready to do a hostile embargo. But yet the hostile embargo is what the Bible prophecies in Ezekiel 27 and Isaiah 23 prophesy. And so you're already starting to see now, as you're closing embassies, heightening trade war, as America and China go through the painful process of divorcing their two economies.
Mm-hmm. Where is the China-America clash leading? That was our editor-in-chief's article in the... this was the August 2020 edition. Go check that out. We'll link to that in the show notes, and thank you for that, Andrew. Our last story on today's program, the world's largest dam in China, is under terrible pressure right now because of intense flooding. It's really only one of several problems hitting China. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, several regions in China have been grappling for the last month with just extraordinary levels of rainfall and flooding. They have more than 430 rivers across the country that are flooded right now. And there's already been one major dam in Guangxi that has collapsed. And then the area that is hit hardest is Wuhan and other parts of the Hubei province that lie along the Yangtze River there. So Wuhan and Hubei province, of course, have been in the news a lot this year, since that's where the coronavirus first emerged and where it really hit China the hardest. And now it's starting to dominate headlines once again because of this terrible flooding that's happening there. But we've already seen 141 people killed or missing and presumed dead. There have been 150,000 houses that have been destroyed, 38 million people evacuated. In one area right now, there are about 10,000 people trapped by floodwaters after some levees were breached. And then what's most concerning here is that the Yangtze River has swollen to near historic volumes. And what you mentioned there, the famous Three Gorges Dam, which is the world's largest dam in terms of how much power it generates. But that dam now is in serious danger of breaking. The floodwaters have apparently already deformed the shape of the dam, and then water levels are still rising. So that could be just catastrophic for so many towns and cities downstream from that dam. But even if the Three Gorges holds, this is still a serious weather disaster that China's facing.
So put this in context of what else China is facing right now.
Yeah, it's been a really rough year so far for Xi Jinping, the head of China. The national security law that he implemented over Hong Kong and the human rights abuses that have been revealed against China's Muslims, both of those have worked together to really help a lot of the world to see just how vicious the Chinese Communist Party that he leads is. And then he has also apparently lost any hope of a peaceful reconciliation with Taiwan. The United Kingdom and several other nations have recently joined the United States in boycotting some of China's most advanced technologies as well. India and Japan are now openly working against China. Even the Philippines has really started to shift courses against China. And then there's the tensions with the U.S. that Andrew just spoke about, and just the trade war that has taken a significant bite out of the Chinese economy. And then, of course, the coronavirus that broke out in China last year, and just millions of people that have been left unemployed by that, and all the animus that's come against China from the rest of the world as a result of that virus being unleashed. And so now, on top of all of those problems that you already had, now you have this serious weather disaster. And Geopolitical Futures wrote this week that all of this could end up presenting some fairly grave political risks to Xi Jinping and his government. They wrote, quote, "No one will blame the Communist Party of China for the rain, but if authorities are seen mismanaging either the floods or the relief efforts, or say if they are believed to sacrifice one city to save another, things could get ugly. Given all the other internal pressures Beijing is trying to navigate, its margin for error here is perilously thin." So there is a lot that Xi Jinping is contending against, and just a lot of moving parts, I think, for us to keep a close eye on.
And just briefly, how do you see this playing out prophetically?
Well, that's a really big part of this. You know, the axis that Xi Jinping's China has built with Vladimir Putin's Russia stands out as one of this century's defining geopolitical developments. And because of China's, just its military and economic power, analysts almost always view China as the head of that axis and Russia as the junior player. But Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said that Russia and Vladimir Putin will soon dominate that axis, even though Russia's population and economy are a lot smaller than China's. And that's because of Bible prophecies, especially in Ezekiel 38, which Mr. Fleury has said reveal that Putin will be in charge of an end-time Asian confederacy. So, you know, the Trumpet has really been expecting some events to happen in a way that would reduce Xi's power relative to Putin's, and also reduce China's power a little bit relative to Russia's. And we don't know exactly what will happen with this flooding and with the coronavirus and everything else that's going on with China right now, but you could see how it could work in a way that rebalances the power in that Russia-China axis in the way that we've been watching for.
We sure appreciate that very much, Jeremiah. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that is it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Calvin Coolidge: "Don't expect to build up the weak by pulling down the strong." Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.